Welcome to Online for Authors, where I, Terry M. Brown, author of character-driven fiction and host of the podcast, introduce readers to characters they'd love to invite to lunch by interviewing authors, discussing their books, learning about the writing process, and even, on occasion, chatting live with a panel of authors to discuss topics relevant to both readers and writers. My guest today on the Online for Authors podcast is Laurie A. Egan, author of the book, The Psychologist's Shadow. Laurie is the author of 13 novels and 4 limited edition poetry volumes. In my book review, I stated The Psychologist's Shadow is a psychological thriller that had me hooked from the first chapter. Ellen Haskell is a psychologist who recently moved her practice to remove herself from a bad situation. Somehow, it seems that bad situations follow Ellen, and she soon finds herself in the middle of an obsession. Laurie does a wonderful job casting light on several patients and even a family member who could be behind the phone calls, notes, and trinkets. I didn't figure out the stalker. I had ruled out some because they seemed too obvious, and others because of specific things that happened during the action. I actually thought it was one of the patients that I didn't want it to be. I even suspected patients ruled out by Ellen, figuring she was missing something. Finally, I suspected a past boyfriend. Although I hadn't ruled out the real stalker, I certainly wouldn't have bet my life on it. Laurie did a great job keeping the reader guessing. Although I tend to shy away from thrillers because they often get too graphic, Laurie provided all the suspense necessary without adding gratuitous violence. This is a must read. Today on the Online for Authors podcast, I'm chatting with Laurie A. Egan, author of The Psychologist's Shadow. Hello, Laurie. Welcome to the show.
Hi, Terry. Thank you for having me.
I am so excited to have you here. Before we really get into the book, why don't you give everyone just like your quick elevator pitch as to what The Psychologist's Shadow is about?
Well, this takes place in 1992 in Princeton, New Jersey, and the main character, Ellen Haskell, Dr. Ellen Haskell, is a therapist who's just moved to the Princeton area after having a really tragic, traumatic episode with a client, one of her clients in New York City. So she's starting her new practice and she's got new clients. So this is told from Ellen's perspective as she meets her different new clients, and we sit in on sessions. So what's really sort of fun is that we get to, and I got to don the therapist hat. And then interspersed between her narrative and these various sessions is a very discordant, usually about a half a page of the stalker's diary. And what happens is that this doesn't really give you a lot of information, but it shows that somebody really is unbalanced.
Right.
So Ellen is just going along and thinking everything is going pretty well. And then all of a sudden she starts getting hang up phone calls. This is 1992 when you had answering machines. And then she starts getting little gifts at the bottom of her stairs. So she is really quite unprepared for this and doesn't quite put it all together for a little bit. And then slowly she starts getting these phone calls at home, and she's living in her parents' house there in Greece, but it's on two or three, it's in a large acreage of forest. So she's really by herself in essentially a modern glass house. And when these calls start happening and she realizes she's got a follower, doesn't know who it is. So this is really about this cumulative kind of simmering suspense that starts out with her being really pretty ignorant of what's going on.
Exactly.
And then, boom, she realizes she's got a really
Realizes she's in the middle of something really, really not good, right?
Yeah. Yes.
So Goodreads calls this a slow burn suspense. I want to know, what is your definition of a slow burn suspense?
Well, in this case, she's not really aware that she has a stalker. So a lot of it begins with introducing the client. So there's an initial journal entry that is obviously something off, sort of like a prelude. And then she winds up getting really more and more concerned as she tries to figure out who the identity of this person is. So it starts out rather on the slow side, in the sense that we get to meet the characters and we're in her shoes.
Right.
We don't think that there's really a big problem.
So we don't start in the center of the action.
Exactly.
So that's what makes it a slow burn. When I did my review, I called it a psychological thriller, which is something that I noticed that Amazon has you in that. What is the difference then between like a slow burn suspense and a psychological thriller?
Well, I would actually call this a psychological suspense, just
okay.
As thrillers, I tend to think of more of as the Dan Brown, Robert Ludlum, the cases where the agent is running all over the world and always has money in his pocket and gas in his car and a free airline tickets.
And lots of bullets.
lots of bullets are fine. This is not that kind of a book. This is really a psychological suspense. In the sense that as we go along, we realize something's not okay. And we're, sitting in on these sessions. So this very diverse cast of characters who are her clients. And each one has got their own little quirks and presentations. So, in many ways that it takes a little while. So I wouldn't necessarily call this a thriller, but I would say it's suspenseful and it's definitely a psychological genre type of book.
So why did you choose a psychologist to be one of the main characters?
Well, it just seemed to me to be, this was actually a manuscript I started back in 93 and I put it aside for a long while and then I got back to it and did major revisions on it. I've always been very interested in psychology. I took some classes at Carnegie Mellon when I was there undergraduate, supposedly studying fine arts and graphic design and photography. But I really was very excited by doing case studies and reading various, theories about psychology, which I've always sort of tried to keep up with. So one of my interests has always been in this field, and I did a lot of research for this particular book, so I got the presentations correct. But that's where I started from. I've always enjoyed, writing from a therapist point of view.
Yeah.
I almost thought about it as a career, but then I thought, not for me.
So isn't that funny, Laurie? So did I. I actually started my master's degree in family counseling and went 2 semesters. And then just realized I can't put it down. I can't put people's problems down. And so I would come home with all of these things because they start you out doing a lot of these practice therapy sessions with people who they already know don't have anything super major. This is just, just little issues that they have. And so here I am practicing and I'm taking all of their problems home. And I knew it was never going to be a good thing for me. So I think that's funny. I too find psychology, sociology, those kinds of things just enormously interesting. And and I wonder if having those things in the back of our mind as writers, we can't bring things out, even if you're not looking at it from a psychologist's point of view.
Exactly. And I think, most good writers should be psychologists in many ways because they have to understand their characters. And
exactly.
They have to understand their history and how that interfaces with how they present in the time that the novel is happening. And I think, if you don't get it, then I think you're going to have trouble. If you don't know, how people behave and how their personalities are forged and what's consistent with their personalities, then I think people, writers are going to have trouble.
I think that might make characters a little flat.
Yes.
Or too, too much like... Well, this is what you expect someone who has autism, or this is what you expect someone who, and that you don't get outside of that very narrow lane of, what makes this person. So it's.
Yes, exactly. You get sort of a cardboard character.
Yeah. A little two-dimensional. So tell me then a little bit about this research. You said you had to do a lot of research to kind of get to know these clients. So tell us a little bit about some of these clients and like what they came in with and what kind of research you had to do to make them real?
Well, I didn't have so much trouble with the clients as I did with the stalker. That's where I did most of my research, because as I learned, there are various different kinds of stalkers. And when this takes place in 1992, New Jersey did not have any anti-stalking legislation passed yet. They did shortly after. California did. But as a result, the police who are involved in this case, both the state police and the local Princeton group, they really were handcuffed because they couldn't really do much to follow up on this case, because they really didn't have anything to back them up. And so, and the fact that she was a therapist, she had to protect the identities of her clients. So that was really a problem. For the stalker, this particular one fell into the category of an erotomaniac, or and that is a real misnomer, because it sounds like they're really sexually deviant or crazy or something. But in fact, it doesn't necessarily mean that. It means that they are very obsessive. And like other manias, like pyromania or some religious manias, for example, they're absolutely driven and stuck on the person that they've affixed their attentions on. And this derives from a character who usually has nothing much in their core self that they feel really lacking. And so they select someone that to them seems like they're very strong, very intelligent, attractive. They have all the things that
they wish they had.
Stalker doesn't have.
Right.
And so this becomes a very interesting dynamic in this book. And this is one of the, you know, the tricks that Ellen is trying to figure out: who in the world of her clients or acquaintances or one family member could possibly be the person doing this. And so she's learning about this too, because it was just becoming more prevalent in the news. There was a celebrity stalker in California who actually killed somebody, the object. So this can veer into violence, but it doesn't necessarily have to, but they're very, very fixated on the object.
Right. So, you know, you had lots of different characters. And I kind of went right through and I said, okay, I don't think it's this person. And I don't think it's this person. And Ellen doesn't think it's this person. And then something else would be said and I'd go, well, maybe it is this person. I even started suspecting that it could be her old boyfriend that had somehow, like, that he wasn't even really brought up. But I thought, that's going to be it, because he hasn't been brought up. Like, I had myself so twisted up that I never did. I didn't ever eliminate the correct stalker, but I never guessed it well enough that I would have bet money on it.
Well, that's always lovely to hear. And you're not alone. I have yet to find anybody who guessed correctly and had that absolute sureness that, you know, the guess was correct. And I have had 3 therapist friends read this.
And they didn't get it
either.
I think that's really fascinating that you're able to create enough tension within other characters that, you know, like, is it a male? Is it a female? Is this person young? Is this person old? Is this person actually a client? Or is it someone else in her life that just happened to follow her into her new area? You know, those things. And yeah, I never was able to separate it out. And I kept reading and thinking, certainly I'm going to get information that's going to help me. And certain things would narrow it down for a while. And then my imagination would go again. And it was just like, oh, now they're all open for, you know, all again. I had a fear it was a particular character that I had kind of come to love, and I didn't want it to be this character. So I was actually glad. I won't spoil anything, but I was actually glad that it wasn't that character, because I had kind of come to like this person, and I thought, oh, please don't make it this one.
Well, that's it. I mean, there's some interesting characters in there. And you know, it's I had so much fun doing these because it was just like, I like doing case studies. And, you know, right. I had to be attentive to their backstory, their history, what they wore, how they spoke, their physical mannerisms, and what they were doing on a daily basis. And for each person that I mentioned, I had to give them the ability to match up to the behavior in the journal entries in terms of timing, or when little gifts were left on the stairs or calls were made, it had to work so that all the possibilities could have done it. And that really had me, that was difficult.
I am sure.
Very difficult.
Yeah, because you're having to keep control of, you have a wide cast of characters. It's not like you have one or two people. You have this wide cast and they all need to look guilty.
Mm-hmm.
And yeah, so you have to give them just enough crazy that they could be guilty, but not so much that you give it away. And you did wonderfully. I was really impressed with that. So
well, thank
good
you.
Job. Did you find it difficult really to keep all of them straight? Like who was doing what?
Well, I wrote calendars down.
Okay.
And then because these were sessions, they followed one upon each other. So Monday I would have, you know, maybe a couple of people. They would always come at 2 o'clock, 3 o'clock, four
right.
o'clock, et cetera.
Right.
So I kept track of all of those. And that was one thing I did. And then for each character, and this is something I always do when I'm writing, I write a full description.
Okay.
As much as I can figure out about what the person wears, their background, their age, hair color, eye color, all that stuff, so that I had a really pretty good idea of each person as an individual.
Right.
And as I say, I always do that just because I have lots of senior moments otherwise.
So do I. And what I end up doing a lot of times, if I have one of those senior moments, I highlight it in yellow and I just put, like, I've done things before, like forgotten a character's name because they're a minor character, but they've come up again. And I'll just put, you know, man that always wears green. And then I highlight it in yellow. And then I keep typing because then I'll go back later. And it's like, we got to figure out who this guy is, but I don't want to stop then and go back. So I like your idea of kind of like keeping a character log that has all of that main information.
Yeah. And a calendar. And I also do sketches of the floor plans of any houses or buildings that are important or properties that are important so that I can remember what room I'm in. And,
right. Can I really see the garden from here? Right.
Right. Right. You know, this particular one, it was a little easier for me because I used a friend's house that I had lived in briefly. On the outskirts of Hopewell in the Sauerland Mountains. And then I had lived just maybe about a mile away. So between living in the one house and then my own house, both of which were contemporaries, it really made it a little easier for me to keep track of where everything was
and like how someone could be spying on her and not be seen.
Yeah.
Oh, mm-hmm. That kind of creeped me out a little bit.
Well, this is a house that, you know, she's far enough away from a very small road that, you know, when her parents built the house, they just didn't think that there would be a privacy issue. I mean, it just wasn't a big deal. I mean, they had, you know, tons and tons of bushes and trees in between themselves and the road, and there wasn't much traffic on the road. So, you know, this was a house that was built to be looked out of rather than into. And which is always a fascinating thing, because I think that that's one of the reasons people either buy a house or don't buy a house, because they either like looking out or they like being looked at.
Yes. Yes. So I would think that a house like that, I would love a house that had, you know, the big windows. On the other hand, I do have a fear of the idea that people could see in. So I don't know. I think that maybe I would probably say, oh, I'm going to love this. And then the first night that I was alone, I would be the one who's like tiptoeing in the dark to see if there's anyone out there that can see me. So
Yeah, I remember being a little creepy, you know, creeped out a few times when I was, you know, living in this house, and you know, I had glass all over the place, and
It's not the kind that you can just put curtains on.
No,
you know, they're usually on those kinds of homes, or at least what I envisioned was that the tall, almost floor to ceiling type,
and
whole walls,
a lot of sliders. Yeah.
So wonderful. So you are a prolific writer. This is what I learned. And that you have 13 novels and 4 poetry volumes and hundreds of stories and in anthologies and on and on. Is everything you write suspense?
No. I am one of those writers that probably frustrates my readers because I go all over the place. I think psychological suspense is my favorite genre, but I just recently, I published a couple of literary works, one last December that I just love, which is, were two partially linked novellas. It's called The Black Leopard's Kiss and The Writer Remembers. And it has some magical realism and with, you know, a little touch of Orlando, Virginia Woolf's Orlando. But I've also dabbled a little bit in young adult and comedy. I wrote a very funny, I think very funny novel called Fabulous about a gay opera tenor who is down and out in New York City, very talented, but he winds up having to make some money, and he auditions as a soprano. So he gets all dressed up to a, you know, and gets hired to sing Gilda in Rigoletto. So the poor guy is running around, putting on wigs and dashing all over the city and taking them off and trying to remember if he has makeup on when he's supposed to be a tenor. And it's a very madcap piece. So I've tackled that as well. So I really am a bridge writer. I really go all over the place. I write whatever comes to me, really.
So Lori, you and I are going to have to talk more later because I think I have met a kindred soul. Good. I've written 3 historical fiction, but they're not anything alike. One is in Ukraine, one is in the United States and Germany, one is in the Appalachian Mountains, North Carolina. They're all different time periods. And now the one I'm currently writing is a contemporary comedy about a woman going through menopause. And then I have a young adult fiction idea in my head that I started. And I have another one that has a fantasy element in it that I've started. And I keep telling people, I think I may be committing author suicide because I have these 3 historical fiction, which I do love to write, but that I don't want to be a historical fiction writer. I want to be a writer. And like, if the story comes, I want to write it. And the fact that you just said that, it's like, oh, I've met my people.
Well, I don't think, you know, that many writers branch out. I mean, there are some that do, absolutely. But I think it's really important to follow your trend, you know, whatever's good for you. I mean, you need to follow your own guidelines along this. I mean, yes, we write for our readers, but mostly we write for ourselves because, frankly, you know, small press publications, you don't have that many readers to begin with. So, you know, and you're not going to get paid a fortune for your work. So, you know, you have to satisfy your own needs and, you know, what makes you curious to follow.
I have characters that kind of, I have characters that pop up in my head. And so they start chatting and if I can get them to go away, then I know that they really weren't much of anything. But if they just continue and they're persistent, it's like, you know, I'm going to have to follow that. I'm going to have to see where that story goes. And I tell people that I'm not really a historical fiction author. I'm a character-driven fiction author. If you like a good character, then you'll like my books, whether I set them in the past or in the present or in the future or in some place that doesn't even exist. You know, that's just what I do. So yeah, we'll see how.
Well, your channeling idea is exactly, has happened to me on several occasions. And like this gay tenor that I just mentioned in Fabulous, I was sitting on my deck one day doing absolutely nothing. And in he plopped and he wouldn't shut up. He just kept, and he was so funny. Yeah. And I said, okay, you win. So I rushed into the computer and out he came with his particular voice, his mannerisms, his history. I knew everything about him within, you know, a couple of hours. And he just stayed with me. And then I had another character, Django Jax, who is a homeless Korean vet that came to me. Now, where they come from, I don't know.
I know.
You gotta go with them if they're there. Not every book has that. You know, it doesn't always happen. But
boy, when it does, isn't it fabulous? I love that.
Yeah.
So, Lori, are you a plotter or a pantser?
I often know the ending, the goalposts that I'm trying to reach, but I don't necessarily know how I'm going to get there.
Okay. So you're a little of both, maybe. You have a little of both.
I don't do outlines or, you know, pre-plan everything. I'm more organic than that. And I like to, you know, learn my characters, meet them like new friends, and, you know, learn how they would behave, because, you know, you don't know your guys and gals so quickly right at the first.
Right.
So as they develop, then you realize, well, you know, this wouldn't do this the kind of thing, but it would do this. So you have to be a little flexible, I think. And I admire, you know, people that construct these extremely complicated murder mysteries, like Marie Hanna, for example. I've been reading a lot of her work recently. Or Val McDermott, but, you know, I couldn't do that. I don't know how they keep all of it straight. So I would say I start out with an idea where I'm trying to get to, but I try to be flexible. Yeah,
that's what I do. I tried an outline one time because I thought that's the way an author had to do. And I felt kind of bad about the fact that that's not what I do. So I thought, okay, well, I'm going to do this outline. And my characters kind of refused to play. I felt like they were standing along the wall with their arms crossed saying, let us know when you're done with that experiment and we'll get on with the writing, you know, it'd be like, okay, so this is what we're going to do. And I could almost hear characters in my head saying, I'm not going to do that. I would never do that. I'm not doing it. So, you know, and it was like, fine. And I gave up my outline, and then things started going just the way they should for me. So I think I'm an organic writer as well, where I don't know, I've had characters that I thought were going to be secondary that turned into something far more.
Yeah, it can happen. But I think that's what's fun. I mean, you know,
it's
like meeting new friends, and that's exciting. I mean, you know, and then you just have to follow along with them just as you would a real person, you know, because as they reveal parts of their history and background to you and how they feel about things, and you get an idea who they are. Well, you know, you have to respect that.
Right.
Absolutely.
Right. And then sometimes I love it if I'm doing, like, I feel a little stuck, like, okay, so we've taken a turn here, and then I'll do a little bit of research and I'll find this little tidbit of knowledge that is like, that's the answer. That is the answer to my problem here, because that is going to allow this story to move forward into the next place. And there is just something really wonderful about the learning process and the discovery of, like you said, the characters and certain scenes and pieces of information that are just going to make everything stand out. I love the whole process.
Yeah, it's funny. You know, if you get yourself painted into a corner in a plot, and, you know, good luck going to sleep that night.
But, exactly.
You know, and if you do fall asleep, you're going to wake
up.
You're
going to dream it.
And, you know, I always keep paper by my bed, because I know, particularly when I'm in the throes of writing something, I know what's going to happen. And, you know, I think that's part of the fun. Again, you got to sort of think your way around get out of a corner that you put yourself into, you boxed yourself into. So
that's like, that's okay, there's got to be a way out of here, right?
Yeah. There is, usually.
Yeah. So in addition to being an author, I see that you are also the reviewer for the New York Journal of Books.
Yes.
Tell us a little about that. What is that?
Well, it's not the New York Review of Books, nor is it the New York Times. I was contacted by this company and asked to review, and I don't get paid for this, but I get free books, which
that's
is nice.
Payment. And,
I get to pick my own books. What they do is publishers contact them, and then they post them in various categories, and then all the reviewers can keep, you know, checking in and seeing what new books are out there. And then if we're quick, we can say, yeah, I'd like to do that one. And then the publisher will eventually send it to you. And what's nice about them is they allow me to be a bit of a crab sometimes. I'm working on a book right now, which I thought was going to be great. But the author writes in extremely staccato lines with hardly any verbs, even in the narrative, and it's just driving me crazy. So I'm going to say that, you know,
right.
And I try to balance it and use good quotations and everything. But I also do a fair amount of reviews for other authors because, you know, either as a swap or just as an offer. Like I have a couple of authors, I really like their work. And even if they don't give me a freebie, an advanced reader's copy, and I buy the book myself, I will usually post my reviews on my blog and also on my social media places, because I think, you know, authors need all the help they can get, even famous ones.
I agree. It's one of the reasons why I do the podcast is, you know, I have the ability now to read books. So, you know, that's one of the things that I ask is give me a digital copy of your book so that I can read it, make sure that it's really a good fit. And then I review it and get it out there in all the places I can get it out there. And then we get to talk about it in person. And I just love, well, first of all, I love meeting other authors and finding out like what makes them tick and are they more like me or different from me and what kinds of tips would they give and those kinds of things. And then I love reading books of most genres. There are only a few that really don't suit me. I don't care for super dark and I'm not into erotica type things. But other than that, I'll try most anything and see, you know, like, how do I feel about it? And like you, sometimes I think, oh, I'm going to love this book. And it's like, oh, it isn't suiting me at all. And then you have to figure out how do you handle that in a way, because I know as an author, you've put your heart and soul, you know, into your writing and you don't want to just be cruel. So you have to find a way, you know, like you don't want to just say, well, that just, and then I always have to temper it with not every book is for every person. And so this could be that it was a bad choice on my part, that this is just not the right book for me. And so the tempering of it.
Yeah. But it's interesting because that way I look at the structure of the book, the bones of it, because that's what I do for myself. And so I probably have a little different take on it, as you probably do also, than the average reviewer who is mostly a reader.
Right. Right.
Yeah.
So do you, when you're reading, Not for a review, but just because you chose to read. Do you have trouble reading for pleasure without picking things apart or saying things like, oh, I don't like the way that dialogue is flowing? Or
yeah. Guilty. Yeah. And then also, I was a book designer for my career at Princeton University Press.
Okay.
And I worked for about almost 25 different major publishers in the academic world, university presses,
right,
and museums. So my sense of typography and design is extremely elevated. And when I see some of the nonsense I see on books today, that can make me crazy. In fact, you know, my new publisher, Andrew May, who is in London, you know, he's a wonderful guy and I have a great relationship with him, but you know, he still hasn't figured out how to get rid of a widow at the top of a page, which is a short line, the end
right.
of a paragraph. Drives
right.
me nuts. Absolutely makes me crazy. I mean, I've sort of talked him through a bunch of things, like how to use hyphens and, you know, the rules of, you know, how many characters you can have before a break and word spacing and that kind of thing.
Right.
But, you know, that will also make me crazy if I see a book that, and frankly, when I see a book with a lot of typographic issues or really crude design, I think this is not a good book because this is a poor publisher.
Right. It doesn't feel good when you read it. I agree. So tell me, Laurie, what is next for you?
Well, Andrew sort of cleared me my desk off last spring. He took four books of mine, four manuscripts, and they all came out. The next one is due next month. In fact, I just got the proof today, the paperback proof from
Amazon. Oh, how fun. Isn't that one of the most amazing things to get the proof?
Well, yeah, except that Amazon totally made a misery of my front cover, because I also designed the cover.
Oh,
and
no.
I'm just, fuming. So anyway, but Andrew took one. We published in August, The Firefly, which is a romance, really, and a coming-of-age portrait. And then this book, The Psychologist's Shadow, which is, was in November. And then the two novellas that I mentioned a minute ago came in December. And then Jack and I, which is a book about a boy with dissociative identity disorder, which is the old multiple personality disorder, it is really sort of fun. And again, it's sort of in that psychological suspense category, but it's also a portrait. So that's coming out. And what I've got on my desk right now are two completely different projects. One is a murder mystery called Fair Haven, which is actually a town near me. And I love the irony of the name with a murder mystery. This is a book that I also started. It was either my first or second attempt at a novel. And I had it under the mattress all those years. And then Andrew cleared me everything out. So I thought, well, maybe I should look at this again. And I was groaning and swearing at myself. I can't tell you the curse words coming out of my mouth. I couldn't believe how bad it was. But the plot was good. The characters were good. And I thought, can I fix it? So I have been working on this big, big manuscript. It's huge. And I kept thinking, I can whittle this down. Keep getting bigger. So I have a policeman who worked in Fairhaven, and he's reading it right now to give me some pointers about things I got wrong.
Oh,
and
good.
I'm reading on him. And then the second project, I just decided while I was twiddling my thumbs, was to do another story collection. And so right now the tentative title for that is Contrary. And I have 20 short stories, some even flash fiction, a number of which have been published, but not in a book.
Right.
And then I'm thinking about adding a play that I wrote, a two-act play, and maybe a piece called The Triangle Quartet about a love affair from a distance that never happened. And it's set over 2 months, but it's in four parts. So, the lover was married. So this is where the triangle came in. I have no idea whether I'm actually going to include these two or not.
Right.
A little too close to home.
Right. Well, yeah, I know it's, I've never tried. So short story is not something that I'm good at. I actually got my first short story is coming out in an anthology in June, which is just really exciting for me. But short stories scare me. I can do flash fiction, like micro flash fiction, and I'm good at it. I can do the 50 word or less ones. And I get a lot of those published. Like people are like, ooh, we love that. And then I can do the 82,000 word novels. And those things in the middle I spend too long developing, and then I don't have any room left. And then I try to get rid of some of what I developed. And then I don't know. I think I really would like to take a good class or something in a short story to give me a better understanding of what's supposed to be happening. How? Like, I feel like I'm just blundering around. And the one that I managed to get into an anthology, I think it was luck. Like, I'm not sure that I know what I did to get it. So,
well, short stories are definitely a different critter. And
they are.
You know, there's usually a single arc, whereas, a novel has multiple ones.
Right.
And you know, you have to set the hook right at the beginning and you have to follow through quickly. And yet you have to, include a huge amount of information so the characters and the locations come alive. It is a challenge.
Yeah.
I hadn't done any short stories for a while. And then when I got it into my head to do this new collection, I thought, well, I better go write some more. So I just wrote 5 stories this last, 4 weeks. And I had more fun. It was such a nice relief that I didn't have to keep all this stuff in my head, you know? So I enjoy doing them. But I also really love writing the novels, the big work,
Right.
A major course, multiple course meal compared to a little snack.
Right.
So
I think for me, I get bored very easily. So, I wrote 3 historical fiction and it was kind of like, okay, so I can do that. Now what else should I try? Like, I don't know. It's like, and I believe I'll go back and write some more because I love that genre. I love to read it. I also enjoy the writing it. I love the research that goes into it. I really enjoy it. But there's part of me that like craves something new, something different. And so, I think short stories might be something that might be next on my plate. I think I need to go back and look up. I believe I've signed up for like a little 2-hour long short story course that I thought would maybe give me insight into where it is that I feel I keep going wrong.
Well, there are really a couple of ways to approach it. I had a friend that was thinking about starting a story and I said, well, maybe come up with a first line that's really snappy.
Yeah.
Really, as I said, puts the hook in. And then the story may just flow from that.
Right.
It's fine. And, or a name, the Django Jacks novel that I later wrote came from a short story by that name. And I woke up one morning with that name in my head and I had no idea where he was coming from. So sometimes the name, and I've also been using locations, places in the world I've visited that have stuck in my mind.
Right.
So that can sometimes unleash with, a whole idea because, there might be something very particular about that setting that will give you an inspiration. So, those are some of the things you might just try. I don't know.
That sounds great. Thank you. Thank you. So, that's great. So if someone wanted to reach you and they wanted to get to know you a little more or learn about one of your other books or just chat with you about, reviewing or whatever, how do they find you? How do they get up with you?
Well, I have a website. It's LaurieAEgan.com, www.LaurieAEgan.com. Right. And there is a contact on there on the website. But it also describes all the books that I've written, including the 4 volumes of poetry. And it also has a page for some of the photography that I've done because that was an earlier part of my career. I still teach fine arts photography to students, adult students online now. And a lot of my covers have my own photographs on them, which was fun. Like I did the design for The Psychologist Shadow and these were masks that I had in the house.
Oh, that's cool. I didn't realize that.
I got to do my own photographs. And, that's really, it gives me a lot of pleasure because that was an earlier part of my career. And it gives me a chance to knit my personality together a little bit.
I love that.
And my history. So, I'm also on Twitter or X. I'm on Facebook more often than Instagram, but I'm on both of those
Fantastic.
As well and LinkedIn.
I'll have all that in the show notes. So anybody will be able to look that up.
And there's an author's page on Amazon as well.
Okay. Awesome. So is there anything that you wish that I had asked you that I didn't ask?
Let me think. Probably not, but I would love to hear if anybody buys the book, The Psychologist Shadow, and reads it and figures out who the stalker is ahead of time and doesn't cheat. I would love to hear about it. I'm really curious. It's been a lot of fun hearing the comments from people that have read the novel. So I think that would be a lot of fun to hear. And I'm always happy to hear from readers.
So am I. I love just chatting about books. Well, Lori, this has been fabulous. Thank you so much for being on the show with me today.
Thank you, Terry. It's been fun. Yes.
Thank you for listening to Online for Authors, where I, Terry M. Brown, author of character-driven fiction and host of the podcast, introduce readers to characters they'd love to invite to lunch. Tune in next Tuesday for another podcast episode.